You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Yeah, on a Monday morning. Let me just tell you this. I'm all about the French, okay? And I've never been about the French. I am, like, that Macron dude, right, gave the president a sapling from near the fountain of the devil dog at Belleau Woods. Come on! Right? The Marine Corps, we are all about Macron. I love that guy. The charm offensive, man. Anyway. Yeah, I'm seriously. Guy's legit. Anyway, we got to call Grant Newsom.
Yes, I can speak in.
Grant, what do you think of Macron? First of all, welcome to All Marine Radio on a Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning. I mean, is that the surf I hear in the background, or is that just the swoosh of a bad Skype connection?
Probably the latter.
All right. He's a Hawaii guy, so you have to ask. You never know. You could be like Tom Selleck rolling around on the beach and stuff like that. Just so you know, Grant, I don't know if you know this, but that house is up for sale. They're going to demolish it. Did you hear that?
No, didn't know.
Yeah, I'm just telling you. I don't want to tell you how to live your life, but being a rich and affluent, world-trotting commentator on life, you might want to check into it. It might be something you could pick up for pennies.
You know, with my checkbook tomorrow.
I like that. What do you think of Macron coming to the United States with a sapling from Belleau Woods for the president to plant at the White House? I just became a fan of the French. It's not like it's hard to buy my allegiance.
Well, yeah, you know, I was impressed. It's nice to have the French coming and trying to be nice, as opposed to some other sort of relationship we usually seem to have with their leaders. We'll see. I think this fellow's has a little opposition in France, I take it. So maybe he has something in common with Mr. Trump.
Question. What do you think of give me your thoughts on Germany. I think one of the things that when we look at the Pacific Rim, I think a lesson that's being taught, retaught to free nations is that you better hang together or you will all certainly hang separately. That freedom is only guaranteed by strength. And in this case, it's a strong alliance, or else you will be set upon and dismembered by the Chinese, who, late last week told the Australian Navy, yeah, you don't belong in the South China Sea anymore, okay? So just get out of here. We own this thing. Germany. So my question is Germany. Germany is a freeloading NATO nation, the largest economy in Europe, in Western Europe, and yet doesn't have a military, so to speak. And in my opinion, and they're one of the primary enablers of the Russians. Your thoughts on all of that? Starting where you want.
Yeah, it's certainly the Germans have shown just how you can make your military disappear if you put some effort into it. If you look at the details, as you obviously have, of what has happened to the Bundeswehr, the German military, it's incredible. Oh. They used to have a couple thousand tanks. Now they have like 300. Half of those don't work. They have no working submarines. Their air force is in equally atrocious shape. What do you say? It's not as if Germany is tucked away in the middle of the Atlantic and Bermuda. It's right on the front lines. And this is what the Germans have intentionally done. There are some Germans, of course, who understand that this is not good. Their intelligence guys are pretty good, as I understand it, and have a keen sense of the problems. But the Germans have just been incredibly stupid. I don't know of a better way to put it. One might attribute it to the hubris that comes of being content and successful. particularly compared to others, and you know, the Germans start to see themselves as some way superior, say, to the southern Europeans, the Greeks, the Spaniards, for example. And it's this hubris that manifests itself in German government behavior towards the rest of NATO, towards the United States, and towards southern Europe. They may have some justification there, the way the Greeks behave. but looking at Mrs. Merkel, the prime minister, it seems that most people tend to do one thing too many in general. And that's what she did. You know, she was doing, I thought, pretty well. And then she let in a million immigrants, forced that on the Germans. But these are Muslim men, young Muslim men. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? And it was the self-righteous certainty with which she defended this, with which she pushed it, foisted it on the German population. And this is going to be a strategic problem for the Germans, it already is. But it really typified, I thought, this incredible hubris that hubris always is incredible, that the Germans came to adopt over the last 70 years. And it is, we'll see how it plays out. You mentioned the Germans and the Russians. There was their prime minister, or president, prime minister Schroeder a while back,
right,
who immediately, like the day after he resigned or was left office, he went to work for Gazprom, the Russian gas company, doing his best to sell out German and Western and really the civilized world's interests in the process. And that, I think his Schroeder, you know, Gerhard Schroeder, pretty much typifies the thinking of a certain sort of part of the German leadership, the German elite, and not in a good way. So that's just a few observations that I've picked up over the years.
How do you turn your back on by all accounts, every nation in NATO other than Germany has increased its defense spending as a percentage of its gross domestic product. Germany says, well, our gross domestic product is growing so rapidly, it doesn't really, our increases aren't really reflected. Right. And then to which I respond, right, in the spirit of Austin Powers, right. So both in the Western Pacific and in Europe, peace through strength, sustained peace, the rule of law through strength, through strong militaries that offer a price that if you want to contest us, it will simply be too expensive. How does one escape that, Newsham? You're an intel guy. That means you're supposed to be, you're part of the Harry Potter crew. You're supposed to like be smart about this kind of stuff. How do you not see that as just a fact of life as a nation?
You could go ask the faculty, say, at any of the Ivy League universities or UC Santa Cruz if you want to answer that question. I don't know. You figure it out once the Mongols show up. And even then, the people who push this don't admit it, or they step back and expect the lower orders to go defend them. I don't know, but it's a problem that's been around forever, I think since Bible days. In Germany's case, back in the 60s and 70s that the German academia was basically dominated by the kind of Marxist that only academics could be.
Right.
And it's still, so their entire academic sort of body that is still heavily influenced by that kind of thinking. It's not, I don't know, it's partly a manifestation, I think, of a willingness to, some sort of belief that military and defense is bad, but also there's a hatred of the West, of the United States, and everything it stands for that's reflected in it somehow. But I don't know. You know, say this is, I think one would be hard pressed to find an example that the contrary is true, that if you disarm, you will have peace. And once again, going back to Bible days, probably the first cavemen understood this. But I can't explain it. I wonder if it's too late because we've never had a sort of an enemy like that has built up its defense as fast and as effectively as have the Chinese. I personally don't think it's too late, but in baseball terms, it's probably the seventh or the eighth inning, and we're down by some runs. But I can't explain it, really. And it's keep in mind that it's in the intelligent people, the intelligentsia, the supposed ruling class, the elite, who are the ones who push this. If you ask the average guy, the average woman, they would understand it much better than the Ivy League PhDs.
Well, you know, you can be, you know, when you go back to the caveman and you look for the first pacifist in caveman history, in the history of the world, the pacifist was the younger brother or the older brother, right, of some caveman by the name of Gronk, okay, or some name like that, right? He was big and he wasn't really smart and he was prone to violence. And everybody knew that if you mess with Gronk's pacifist brother, Gronk will kill you and your whole family. And so the other guy, you know, the flower child, he could be a pacifist because somebody else guaranteed his existence. And so I don't understand, as a nation, that stance that, oh, you know, we've seen the last of war. We have a UN. It intervenes in all kinds of conflicts to make sure that everybody's rights are guaranteed. This could never happen to us. That assumption, I guess. And again, if you look at the lessons around the world, you know, today in the Western Pacific, right, the whole Pacific Rim is learning that China will gobble you up slowly but surely. And in Europe, we're starting to see Russia, who's clearly, there's only one person's agenda. It is for the Russians to behave the way they are, right? And that is, it's astounding to me. Russia's economy is smaller than the Canadian economy. Whose interest is it in for them to reenact the Cold War? It's only in the people that control the nation, Vladimir Putin and his cronies' interests, that happens. It's not in the interest of the Russian people. It's ridiculous. And so I don't understand that. And I have an email. Hey, Mac, as you often say, the sun shines on a dog's ass every once in a while. I think that this discussion is spot on relative to weakness, and we have nations now looking to exploit it. I think Grant's comments about the intelligentsia of a nation are spot on. I cannot for the life of me understand it either. It is a lesson that is redundant in history, and I find it really frustrating. My question to Grant this morning is to go back to your Israel-Iran. Since he is part of the Harry Potter crew, does he think there will be a war between Israel and Iran in Syria or thereabouts sometime soon? Newsham, what say you? I like the whole Harry Potter thing, though, just so you know.
Yes. I don't know how soon, but I just can't help but think it's coming, and say within the next 10, 20 years, something has to give. And either that regime in Iran changes and the sort of the Persians are allowed to be normal people, or this is headed to Knuckle Junction. I just can't see any way around it. I can't imagine any Israeli leader, left or right, allowing sort of another Holocaust to happen and to do or try anything to stop it. So that would be my take. I like that expression, redundant is the right way to describe, I think, all the evidence that this sort of peace through weakness works. But that would be my take with Iran, that it's, you know, you kind of get a little nostalgic when you think of it when it was just Iran,
right,
before China became so threatening. And now with China turning out the way it is, that Iran actually looks kind of manageable. But looking at it, yes, I think that's headed for trouble. And in some days you wake up and for a little while you wish we'd just get it over with, or wish they would get it over with. But I said nothing. I don't see anything good happening with that, and that once again has been a sort of a bipartisan achievement to allow Iran to hang around and do everything it's done since 1978, 79-ish.
That's a good way of describing it. Bipartisan, blundering, just what you could never have done on your own, we will hand to you. It's honestly, it's amazing. And I was talking earlier, but I think it's the work of inept politicians and also the work of inept generalship. Generals who will not stand up and look politicians in the eyes and say, we should not do this, and if you do, I will quit, right? And we can't have this. Excuse me. And so, I don't know, it's very frustrating to watch the missteps of the United States in that region, and what a shit show that we've created. I mean, that whole event, largely enabled by the United States invasion of Iraq, and just, Don Rumsfeld being himself, who, I know you're a fan of him. All right, let's change gears. In fact, somebody mentioned your comments about the whole Okinawa thing relative to Rumsfeld to me a week or two ago. They said, I was listening to, I didn't know that's how all that started. And I said, yeah, Newsom pretty much on that stuff. He's been paying attention to that for a while, too. So for those people who've never heard it, give us a brief look at the whole issue on Okinawa and how Rumsfeld got involved in it and put that thing on steroids.
Everybody's probably who's listening knows that there's always been opposition to the U.S. bases on Okinawa. And specifically, it's the Marine bases. It's not so much the Air Force base at Kadena, but the Marine bases. So there's always been opposition. The Americans and the Japanese had worked out an agreement, say, in the late 1990s, where they would eventually close down Futenma Air Station and move it up north as soon as the Japanese built a replacement. The Japanese promised this in about 1998, and they pretty much did nothing, and they still haven't done very much. But nothing really moved along. And then, but it was the Japanese problem, and they knew they had to solve it before the Americans moved from Futenma or moved anything around, really. And Donald Rumsfeld came to Japan in about, I think it was 2003-ish, roughly. And he, instead of the usual series of meetings, the Okinawan governor, I think, was asked to meet him. And secretaries of defense do not meet governors anywhere. And so Rumsfeld went down to Okinawa, and this was against the advice of the U.S. Embassy and the civilian advisor and military advisors on Okinawa. But he went. And the Okinawan governor predictably was very rude to him, just launched into these, attacks on the U.S., on Rumsfeld, and blah, blah, blah. And it's a very ritual sort of behavior. And the Japanese are used to doing it, and the Americans, and particularly Japanese officials, all bow and say, yes, we're sorry, and we won't do it again, blah, blah, blah. And anyway, Rumsfeld, being Rumsfeld, took great offense at this, and he said, well, if we're not welcome here, we won't be here. Or we shouldn't be here. And this set all of his courtiers, that class of people who all want to be generals and flag officers or the civilian equivalent, and then the people below them who are toadies as well, it set them in motion. And they started this entire sort of furniture rearranging scheme to figure out some way to move Marines around, move bases around, some configuration that would get the mayor of Okinawa and all Japanese to stop complaining. Well, there is no such thing, but they set about it, and that is what has turned into what is called DPRI, Defense Policy Review Initiative, which has been a very nice employment scheme for people. But all it is it's your wife telling you to move the furniture around again because she doesn't quite like the way it looks. She's always going to complain. And that's where it all started with Rumsfeld. But it also has put the ball in America's court. So you would, instead of Japan's, because this is Japan, it is, as last I heard, it's up to them to If they want American forces, it's up to them to take care of local opposition. Instead, it has put the Americans in the position between the Japanese central government and the local Okinawan officials who hate the bases, as we're the buffer. So the central government can blame the Americans, and of course the locals blame the Americans. And it hadn't been for Donald Rumsfeld starting this whole thing in motion, it wouldn't have developed as it has. It's been, it's like, instead of being bad, it's been really, really bad. And it has just been a huge distraction on U.S. attention in this area. So instead of concentrating on, say, getting a decent Japanese defense force that can fight with us, the Navy excluded, we've been worrying about rearranging the furniture. You know, is it going to be 3,000 Marines or 5,000 or 6,000 or 8,000 to Guam? Are they going next year, 10 years from now, 20 years from now? When's it all going to happen? And it's created this cottage industry of civilian employees who and alliance managers who fret about this. It is ultimately less productive activity than figuring out how to fight a war. So that's sort of the long version of Don Rumsfeld's greatness here. And it didn't have to happen if he had just listened to his advice, which in that case was excellent advice and by some people who really knew the subject. So there you have it, all this resentment pouring out at 5:30 in the morning.
The gift that keeps giving, Don Rumsfeld. I'll never forget having General Zinni on and him talking about everything that happened. So frustrating as a former head of CENTCOM himself to watch the Secretary of Defense rip up the war plan and write his own, and everything that happened subsequent was predicted to have happened in the war plan. Just, and how maddening it was, and the arrogance of Don Rumsfeld, and that whole endeavor, right, has spawned part of, you know, the Syrian thing starts with the Arab Spring, right? And then we leave, ISIS grows up there, you know, and you have the cauldron boiling, and then you have displaced people moving into Europe. And really, how do I articulate this? The clash between, you know, young male Muslims from the Middle East with Western Europe democracies, and then now the looming backlash between the middle classes of those nations saying, hey, we don't want any part of this. And then you have the intelligentsia of the nation saying, oh, no, it's our duty and we can make it right. And the middle class saying, yeah, well, we don't see how it works because we're down here living in it and it ain't working. And so all furnished to us by the neoconservatives, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, all that group. So it's amazing history. And we're still acting it out with. Right, the war between Iran and Israel. I got an email from a friend who said, "Hey, put up the bleachers and start making popcorn because it's coming. It's coming because the Israelis aren't backing down from it, and the Iranians, they're not shying away from it either. So it will happen because, as you said, Grant, there is not a liberal or conservative prime minister of Israel that can allow that. So we'll see." We'll see. Now on to easier issues. North Korea. I said last week, you'll know the guy's serious when, for instance, when we say denuclearization, we mean his nuclear weapons off the no mas. Okay. When he says that, he means all U.S. troops off the peninsula, and we say what? So all of a sudden so my point was, when he begins to take those items off the negotiating table, he will have my undivided attention, along with things like, not launching any more missiles, blah, blah, blah. And lo and behold, late last week, a whole series of those things gets announced. And in my mind, I have Newsom's voice talking about Lucy and the football and Charlie Brown. So make sense of all of this to me. Should we take him seriously? Should we take him seriously or not?
Not yet.
Okay.
That would be my advice. I would describe myself, and I got this just yesterday from a friend who's very, very knowledgeable about Asia Pacific, a very good commentator. He's also kind of a loser like me because he's a Philadelphia Flyers fan.
You know what? One of my good friends is the head coach of the Philadelphia Flyers, Dave Hackstall. He's an awesome guy, and they got beat like a rented mule yesterday by the Penguins. So hang in there, Hack.
Okay, well, anyway, he used the expression. I told him I was going to plagiarize it. He says that he is cautiously pessimistic. And that, I think, to me at least, that gets it about right for North Korea. Until you see a regiment of nuclear weapons inspectors going in there, shipping the North Korean hardware to Long Beach, I won't be convinced that he's serious, or opening up the prison camps and just, you know, getting rid of those. Until we see something like that that's really getting into your wallet and pulling out the 20s, that I won't be impressed with this. If you look at what he said, yes, it's so much better than everything we've heard before this, that it sounds like progress, but I still see it doesn't fix anything. He's offering something he can afford to offer, as others have pointed out, that, you know, his systems, his nuclear and missile capabilities have moved along pretty well, and he's got a certain capability. So if he says, well, I'm not going to use it, but that's nice, but it really doesn't mean much when he can turn a switch almost and start using it. But once again, things tend to, sometimes one thing leads to another. You know, and I suppose it's possible that he may really intend to denuclearize the way we look at it, which means what I just described, inspectors coming in en masse and moving the stuff out. And that will require a fundamental change in the nature of that Kim family regime. And I don't quite see that happening. In fact, I don't see it happening. But all of this, everything that we're reading about, if you followed this for, 25 years, and others have followed it much longer than me, but it's great entertainment. You almost don't like to say it, but this is entertaining. This is not like the usual, these grim-faced American diplomats flying to Pyongyang, going to get rolled by the North Koreans, after giving them everything they can possibly give them, which is all predictable. But this is not so predictable, I think. One can be skeptical or cautiously pessimistic about the outcome, but it really is entertaining to see how this is going to play out. I think we will end up where we started. But that said, it's been fun to watch. So cautiously pessimistic is maybe the right expression.
All right. So if you were – so your take on Mike Pompeo, how does Mike Pompeo get to North Korea?
Do you mean like what route does he take?
How does he get there? Does he get on like Air North Korea in first class and fly in there? How does that happen?
How does that work? I think they just fly, don't they? Just fly a U.S. Air Force plane in there.
Would it be painted black? Is there any way to track it? What the hell?
Oh, that's a good question. Because there are those people that follow. Everything. That follow all the planes. So that's a good question. I never thought about it. Or maybe they just look like they're flying to Sweden and like really fast and they take a right turn and
nobody knows. Okay, tell me what you make of Pompeo's visit. Normal due diligence before you go meet Lucy and she pulls out the football again?
I think it's, if you're going to do it, and I think it's never hurts to talk or do something like this. But I think it was probably okay. From what I understand of Mr. Pompeo, he's a good guy and is not really in awe of being in his position. You will get some people who are, appointed head of the CIA, and they're so excited to be the head of the CIA that they they lose any common sense they ever had. But I think he's a smart guy with some sense of context, and I think he's probably getting some good advice. So I think he, if somebody's going to go, I'd have much rather have him go than I'd take one of him more than a dozen John Kerrys or maybe any number of John Kerrys of that sort of what do you call it, these elite know-it-alls who really cause immense harm to our nation. But I think Pompeo will be a good guy to go. I think he did it, apparently did okay. I have no idea what they talked about. But it is one of the nice things about all this is that it suggests that somebody in Washington can still keep a secret.
How about that?
That this didn't get leaked before he went.
And can you imagine the people at the Post and the Washington Post and the New York Times when this news hit? They just looked like, what is going on? Why do we have these leakers if they're not leaking the appropriate content to us? What went wrong? The shit must have hit the fan in those places.
I'm sure they were miffed.
All right, so it's just due diligence. Pompeo certainly selected because he seems like a trusted agent. And so, all right. What does it take? So when you talk about what will break squelch for you, all right, what, it's the arms inspectors going in there? It's what does he have to do to get your attention where you would change from being cautiously pessimistic to cautiously optimistic?
I would say,
I want you to answer this question on top of that. And then what is China's price for whatever China's doing? Blah, blah, blah. Because much hoopla was made after the armored train went to Beijing. The honey bear, right? That's President Xi. Is he still president or is he emperor? Did he change his name when he became president for life?
Not yet. Just a matter of time.
All right. So he evidently called President Trump and said, hey, this is legit. We're talking about he's going to eliminate nuclear weapons or whatever. And then President Trump said, very nice things about President Xi and said, yeah, this is we're going to see. So what is China's price after you answer the initial question?
What I will be impressed with?
Yes.
It's really not so much letting in inspectors. Well, that would be one thing, but inspectors can always be cheated. But I mean, going in with trucks and carting out the nuclear, particularly the nuclear equipment, the hardware, and shipping it off, and but as thorough a look at a country as you could possibly have, with them providing the data. Show us the books, show us the hardware. Show us everything you've got. Then I might be convinced, but that's that can be complicated, and one can always say they're not showing enough. But to me, it would be closing down that system of concentration camps where millions of North Koreans are tortured. If they did that, if they opened them up and said, this is a mistake, we're closing it down, and come watch, then I would, that more than anything would impress me, because it would suggest that the regime is different. And compare it, say, to the Russians when they closed down the Gulag, sort of, when Boris Yeltsin took over. You knew something had changed in Russia when there was this mea culpa, this admission of these just immense crimes towards their own people. So I think when that changes, then I'll be impressed. That would be the one thing, maybe even more so than sounding agreeable on the nuclear and missile business. And also admitting that they killed the brother-in-law or the stepbrother in Kuala Lumpur, that would be helpful. That I would like to see. Opening the books on past North Korean crimes, blowing up South Korean airliners, trying to murder the entire Korean cabinet in Rangoon 30 years ago, or shooting a torpedo and sinking that South Korean Navy ship. If they open up on that, then I'll believe that there's some change. Otherwise, I think they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. And so I won't be impressed. But what is China's price? That's a good question. It would certainly be, I think, that North Korea continue to hate Japan, not go easy on Japan, I think. I think China would like to see if there, whatever happens, if somehow North and South Korea unify, I think they would still like to see them all focused on Japan and making life as miserable as possible for the Japanese.
But how can, you know, this whole discussion of reunification, that means that he goes away. I don't even like why, really? We're going to talk about the two separate states that accept each other and live in harmony, right? Like Ebony and Ivory do. But this whole talk about reunification of the peninsula, are you kidding me? Is there any two nations that live side by side that are more polar opposites? And polar used not in the geographic sense, but in the mental health sense, are more polar opposites than North Korea and South Korea. They're not even anywhere in the same sphere.
I agree. It's not going to happen tomorrow or be easy, and I don't think it's going to turn out the way anybody quite plans. But within, a few things happen. And you could get some movement in that direction. We think that, of course, the South Koreans will have the upper hand, but I'm not so sure of that. And why I say that is that this President Moon of South Korea, he reflects the thinking of a slice of, a pretty big slice of South Korean society that thinks like Jimmy Carter did about the Russians. And that is he genuinely believes that.
Okay, hold on. You forget your age, okay, Nushin. Explain to everybody, footnote, Jimmy Carter thought about the Russians, okay? And how is Carter's thoughts about the Russians any different than Obama's reset button with Hillary Clinton? Obama's thinks that he can deal, thought he could deal with the Iranians. How is all of that the same? I don't know, arrogant, globalist view of the world that we can all get along together. Explain Jimmy Carter first.
Okay, well, it's, I guess I am. I guess you're right.
You refer to the Washington senators on a regular basis, and people are like, what? Yeah, they don't know. They don't know about the Washington senators. So my role as a moderator here is to kind of keep it between the lines.
Okay. Well, James Earl Carter was the president from 1976 to 1980. He believed, as did a slice of America's ruling class, that the reason why the Russians had been a problem and why we had the Cold War was because the Americans frightened the Russians. So everything the Russians did was simply a response to American behavior, and specifically threatening American behavior. So if America backed off militarily, downplayed its military, Russia would respond in kind, and we would have peace and harmony. And part of this is that you could hash things out. If you just meet with these people, talk to them, show them you're not a threat, that they will respond in kind, sort of as if we were dealing with Canadians. And along these lines, Jimmy Carter also called for pulling U.S. troops out of off of the Korean Peninsula, when you were going to get the same response. He was thinking that, well, if they're not there, there's no reason to fight. There's no reason for the North Koreans to behave improperly. So I recall the head of U.S. forces there, John Singlaub, who threatened to resign over this, and Carter backed off. But this is with President Moon in South Korea today. There is a thinking that the North Koreans are their brothers, and they just have to get to know each other. And Moon sees himself as the guy who's going to be able to talk the North Koreans into once again rejoining this fraternity of Korean people. And that is. South Korean Jimmy Carter. He is capable, I think, of doing some pretty considerable harm, in the immediate, in present and the immediate future. if things turn out a certain way. But within South Korean society, the older, much older generation than him, because he's about, I guess, my age, older generation, they have some memories of the Korean War and a sense of North Korea based on that, and also a sense of the United States based on that experience, which is all good in our case and very negative in North Korea's case. In the case of the younger generations in South Korea, they are not as excited about getting together with their North Korean brothers as is Moon's generation, a part of Moon's generation. And that's sort of a simplified way of looking at it. So it's, as you've noted, yes, there's a lot of opposition to what Moon is trying to do within South Korea. But nonetheless, he's in charge and does have some oomph behind him, some support. And that's why, you know, I think that what he's doing, it may go farther than one might think, and not in a good way. And I think you reach a bad agreement, and the other side, if, you know, they're able or willing, can sometimes take advantage of that. Think of the U.S.-Iran nuclear deal that John Kerry and Obama brought to fruition, and how the Iranians have taken advantage of that.
Yes.
Or say that catch and release program for Iranian intelligence officers operating in Iraq who got caught, how the Iranians took advantage of that. The point is that things have a way of working out in ways you don't expect, and this idea of reunification isn't likely, but it's not quite as impossible as one might think. Which this is all a diversion from the question of what is China's price. Other than continuing to hate Japan and not letting the Americans get a bigger role on the peninsula, I'm not sure what China's price actually is. And one might say ultimately, whatever is on the Korean Peninsula, and if it is still a somewhat independent North Korea, continue to ultimately take instructions from China. That would be another reason to be cautiously pessimistic, is just how much will China allow to happen, because they claim they have no authority, no influence over the North Korean regime, but let the North Korean regime try to act sort of independently in a way China doesn't like, and I think you'll find they have all the control they need.
Why did Abe run to Florida? Because he's trying to make sure that the East China Sea doesn't become a bargaining chip. The East China Sea and Taiwan don't become bargaining chips in this grand endeavor between the United States, North Korea, and China?
I think that's the reason, is that Japan's always been very concerned of being left out of any sort of developments or agreements regarding the Korean Peninsula. They're afraid that their interests may not get looked at just as, say, with the same attention American interests get looked at. So that's always worried them. And that is basically the reason why they went, is that, you know, they don't want to have something happen that doesn't benefit them or that disadvantages them. But there's also, of course, a political angle to it. If you go, you show that you're still important, and the Chinese, the Koreans have to pay attention to you. And also domestically, it's useful for Abe to go and be seen as the guy who can intermediate with the Americans, the guy who has this excellent relationship with Mr. Trump. And that helps sort of buck up his position domestically, which is in a little trouble right now. So it's those couple reasons. And it's pretty figure outable. It's not like I don't think there's some sort of game of chess being played and there's three moves out that we can't even conceive of. I think it's pretty much fear of being left out by the Americans. And that's been a common feature of Japanese foreign policy, particularly as it relates to the Americans, going back probably forever, or at least since 1946.
Well, can you imagine words that strike fear in an ally's heart, like the Americans are negotiating. Like, oh my God, look, they don't do well looking after their own interest, right? What the hell is going to happen to our interest? So,
fair enough.
I can imagine how terrifying it would be when the United States sits down to negotiate. My guest is Grant Newsham. We're talking about the world today. Normally, we talk about the Western Pacific, but today we're talking about the world. I want to ask you about something you wrote recently about organized crime in Japan. But before that, I want to ask you just a quick update on the South China Sea. The Chinese held a large naval exercise, sent their carrier out there, and made great fanfare of it. We operated, I think, in the week following that little event. Subsequent to that, with one of our carrier battle groups, which we love to do, and subsequent to that, the Australians were in the South China Sea and got told by the Chinese, get your asses out of here, all right? You don't need to be here anymore. What's the latest on the South China Sea?
Well, it just gets better and better. This is the
Hold on. One more note I have. And tell me about what is the purpose of the jammers that have been deployed to the fortified atolls in the atolls, just so everybody knows, fundamentally different than a-holes, okay? These are atolls in the South China Sea. So, Grant?
The jammers, that's just one more piece of hardware for China to further solidify or strengthen and ultimately solidify its military control of the South China Sea. It's well on its way to basically controlling, having military control, and it already has de facto control. So the jammers, again, it's like a piece of hardware that adds to that.
What are they jamming? Are they trying to jam drone signals or what?
Oh, it's going to be, it's all intended for us. You could be whatever you can jam something with, everything they put out there is intended ultimately to keep the Americans at bay. You can use it on the Australians if you want, but it's really, the Chinese have, since 1989, have been trying to develop the capability to defeat an enemy that has an aircraft carrier. We're the only ones with aircraft carriers. Everything they've done has been designed to fight and defeat us. So we're the target. It's nobody else. The flotilla you mentioned, where the Chinese paraded a boatload of ships through the region or near parts of the region, that was intended to intimidate America, but also everyone else in the region too. This would be, think of a trailer park where you've got some nut who nobody likes, but he's outside his trailer and he's cleaning his shotguns, and then he's cleaned them, reassembled them, and now he's sort of working the actions. Just so everybody can hear it, everybody can see him and be afraid of him. And that's really all that's going on here. And it's been a steady move towards Chinese domination of that particular region. So that's how I saw the events. And if one has followed this over the years, and probably go back to 1992, it has been steady progress, though it sped up really fast during the Obama administration. And here we are. So I think we are going, it's not going to get any better. And at some point, there's going to be an administrative fee slapped on, say, Japanese ships coming through the South China Sea. And then what do you do, America? Or maybe even Taiwanese ships have to pay a little bit for, you know, the Chinese environmental stewardship of the region, and everyone who's using this Chinese territory needs to pay for it. That's just one example of about 100 of ways China's going to make people's lives miserable in that area.
And when you say, look, I didn't see the toll booth, that's why we didn't stop and pay it, China then says, you can pay it, all right? You can pay it, or there will be economic repercussions. Alibaba in the news this morning, for its gangster-like dealings with major American companies and its heavy-handedness and access being the key issue to the Amazon of the East. So everything you've told us is comes to fruition, sadly. Final question for you. You wrote about organized crime in Japan. Tell us about it.
Well, you've only got five more minutes. I wrote an article in response to a recent Japanese National Police Agency report pointing out that the number of Yakuza, or Japanese gangsters, it has gone down last year, as it has for about the last decade. So their numbers are now at their lowest numbers ever, which the implication being from the articles is that, and particularly as Westerners write it, is, well, the Yakuza are going extinct. You know, the Japanese are driving them out of sort of out of business. And I wrote an article saying not so fast, that actually the numbers decline, the decline only represents Yakuza adaptability, and that the Yakuza's influence, their presence in Japan, is just as great as it's ever been. And that was my article. That was my point.
So what is your point? Your point, how formidable are they? Because organized crime, just like around the world, continues to morph as it has greater opportunities electronically to filch money. How has organized crime in Japan changed over the years?
The big change, and this is one way to look at it, it's important to look at it the right way, is that there's a tendency, if you ask people about Yakuza, and I will say that having lived in Japan many years, that, and actually knowing a lot about them, that I've never met a white man in Japan who didn't know more about the Yakuza than I did. It's sort of like if you're, a football coach, yeah, everybody in the stands knows more about football than you. So that off my chest. People hear Yakuza and they think tattoos, missing fingers, curly hair, that sort of thing. And yes, that is part of, there are Yakuza like that. But the Yakuza are best viewed as a spectrum, and the curly-haired tattooed guys are at one end of the spectrum, say shaking down $100 from a bar owner. At the other end of the spectrum, you have very sophisticated businessmen working, who are Yakuza, working hand in glove with Japan's elite, the political, financial, business, governmental elites. And I say working hand in glove. And I think that the Yakuza are best viewed as a giant private equity fund that is now invested and operates in every single Japanese industry. Now, why does this matter? Because financial power is political power. And when you have governments which make their decisions based on what is going to benefit the Yakuza, benefit organized crime, that doesn't always work out so well. One example for the U.S. military, several I could give, but one, if anyone was ever stationed at Atsugi, at the Naval Air Station, they know that there was industrial waste incinerator operating off base, but the stuff it put out, this poison gas, was floating over the base and for years was poisoning the people on the base. I mean, literally poisoning them. And this was a huge issue between the U.S. and Japan. So every defense secretary who would come to Japan would raise this issue to the exclusion of actually developing decent defense military capabilities for Japan or an ability to work with us. So this is what the focus is on, is stopping this incinerator. And it took years, if not decades, to finally close this down. And why couldn't so it was a distraction in addition to poisoning American citizens and American service people and their families. Why couldn't the central government close this down? Well, because it was owned by the Yakuza. And the central government was also sending retired officials to work at this facility. And as post-retirement jobs. And just think about it, and you have to realize, one, just how stupid we are and just what hold the Yakuza have over the Japanese central government. Finally, it was closed down after years, and the Japanese government paid, it was at least $60 million that I know of, to this company to close it down. $60 million to the Yakuza to close down something that's poisoning Americans. And that, if you not just extrapolate, but that gives you an idea, once again, of how influential organized crime is in Japan. The reason why, part of the reason why its economy has been in such terrible shape for so long and gone nowhere is the need to placate the Yakuza and divert money to them. And that's, so I could obviously talk about this at some length, but it does, the point is it does matter. You know, you do have to look at it at, say, from a broader perspective. And it's not just tattooed guys, but it is really organized crime at the just really, I wouldn't quite say having control over the Japanese government, having undue influence. I will say that in one difference between us and the Japanese is in Japan you have organized crime during things. In America we have Ivy League graduates who do it. So that's
I was going to say one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. What about you know, it's amazing now when you look at things like this. The internet has given the Russians opportunities to destabilize Western democracies that they could have never even conceived of years ago. You know, and they must marvel at their success in infiltrating media, getting stories out there that exacerbate situations, all with the, you know, the underlying premise of destabilizing Western democracies, using their own freedom against them, blah, 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 blah. What type of hold, I mean, Japanese society is very closed. As an American, when I went there years ago, you know, you walk, you know, it's coming close to midnight, you're walking down the street, you see a bar, you go to walk in, bouncer puts his hand on your, out in front and says, sorry, we're full, right? And then, you know, eight Japanese people walk right past you and they walk right in. And you look and you're like, hey, man, I thought you said you were full. And they look at you and they say, we are full. Okay. And then more people go past you. Which is, you know, our little introduction to this island nation, this what it is to be Japanese, the sexism that exists on the island, the way business works, their relationship with organized crime. Can you pull the curtain too far back on that? Has, you know, so that the Japanese can go through the 60s? And maybe get into the 70s one day? Or is that all, for very, very good, appropriate reasons, locked down very tightly? I mean, because Korea's gone through it with, you know, the relationship. You know, I mean, their former president, she's in jail now. Between the major Korean companies that run the nation. And the relationship between them and the politicians that run the nation. How far can you pull the curtain back in Japan without pulling the thread, the thread that binds the vertebrae together?
Oh, that's a good question. if you're from Boston, you'd understand it because it's the culture. You know, someone from Boston would just understand Japan perfectly in terms of the sort of the corruption that's worked into the threads, into the garment. I'm not really, it's helpful actually to keep that in mind, but it's part of the structure. Organized crime plays a certain role, and the Japanese political elite, the ruling elite, actually see organized crime as helping provide stability. And particularly where it got its start in the modern era was in what is called the Meiji era, back in the late 1800s. When representative government was introduced to Japan, and each party realized that it needed protection from the other parties, and the Yakuza could provide it. Physical protection, protection from blackmail. And so the Yakuza actually are seen as, one, a reliable voting bloc, a good source of funds, and protection from blackmail, but also the ability to obtain blackmailable information. So to somebody like Prime Minister Abe, he would have no idea why the Yakuza are a bad thing. They're just a necessary part of society. And that is something that's useful to keep in mind, you know, just as, say, a big city mayor in the Northeast in the United States in the 60s and 50s would have seen the mafia as, well, a necessary evil, necessary to sort of keep things running properly. So that is one way of looking at it. But also when you mention Korea, one of the peculiarities is that in Japan you have the Yakuza doing certain things on behalf of politicians, on behalf of the ruling class. In Korea, in general, the ruling class does not want to split the money with the mafia, their Yakuza, so they do it themselves. And you actually will see that, actually it's funny, you'll see Korean politicians, Korean, senior Korean officers, really doing things that Yakuza would do in Japan. So there is actually a sort of an ironic difference between the two countries in that regard, where the Koreans are tighter with the purse strings, whereas the Japanese don't mind spreading the wealth around a little bit more.
All right, final question for you this morning. And again, Grant Newsham, our guest this morning, appreciate him, as always, coming on, but getting up early as he's in Hawaii. Mac, where does Grant think the next shooting war is going to begin? Let me modify the question. Are you more apt to think that shooting will occur on the Korean Peninsula, the South China Sea, or in Syria between Israel and Iran? If you were to handicap that horse race, what would you say?
Oh boy. I would guess, and once again, just a guess, I would put my money on Iran and Israel, but with I would also put a side bet, you know, like you would on something in the East China Sea.
In the East? In the East China Sea?
East China Sea. Now, that would be a side bet with the Chinese not being able to restrain themselves and just cannot resist teaching the Japanese a lesson. So that would be a side bet, but I think I would go with probably Iran and Israel somewhere there. And then as soon as we hang up today, I'm sure I'll think of where it's really going to happen. But that's what comes to mind.
All right.
South Los Angeles, I think. But,
Interesting. Now, I can see Japan has every reason to be nervous about the United States being hoodwinked, reset buttons, all the crazy things that have destabilized different parts of the world that the United States has done. You know, and again, I say that as a proud American, and we have done good things on the planet, but for whatever reason, we want to believe that dictators are capable, that we're capable of dealing with them, and we cave in too easily. We don't drive hard enough bargains, and then we pay for them later. So, just frustrating. And so, to me, the Japanese should absolutely, if they're prudent, lucid leaders, they should be terrified the United States is making deals, because history would teach them that. So, anyway. All right. Anything else? Would you care to comment on Bryce Harper's 408-foot home run with a broken bat?
I noticed that.
How about that?
I would like to have some physics professor explain how that could possibly happen. I don't know.
The strength of 10 Grinches. That's how that happened.
Can't imagine, but I tell you, it's in the bag. That's where you put your money this year.
Well, there you go. The Washington Senator is going to do it this year. But they have a pretty good baseball team. He's pretty amazing. I was reading about him. You know, guys like him and He's kind of a today's version of Alex Rodriguez. Gets to the big leagues so young that, 18, 19, that he's eligible to become a free agent at the age of 25 when he's arguably, he's not even in his prime years yet. He's at the infancy of his prime years and will absolutely annihilate somebody's bank account as he becomes a business partner with an owner, maybe Washington, we shall see. But he's just a phenomenal player. And if you haven't seen it, he didn't crack the bat, okay?
Uh-huh.
He's running with the bat handle in his right hand when he flips it and he hits this thing out of the stadium.
Yeah, I noticed that. That's why I said the laws of physics are sort of intriguing in this case. Yeah. It was quite something.
And they do all that stuff now in baseball with the whole StatCast thing, exit velocity, blah, 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 blah. So I find that the analytical is very, very interesting. Very interesting. All right, sir, anything, what's next on your list of travels and adventures? Where are you headed?
Oh, nowhere soon. I think I'm going to be around for a while. Uh-huh. But, yeah, I don't have any great adventures planned.
Do your daughters prefer you being around, or do they like it when you travel? Or do they like a mix of
one. I don't think she... I have no idea, I'll put it that way. I don't know.
Right.
That's a good question.
You might want to ask. All right, Grant. Thank you for your thanks for the visit. Always enjoy it.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot.
Grant Newsham on interesting discussion today. All right. He's no doubt he's contributed. Everybody who listens mentions him by name in terms of how they now view events in the Pacific Rim, and how he's raised their IQ in the Pacific Rim. All right, speaking of IQ and people with high IQs, Mike Musselman joins us next. Don't touch that dial.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.